Hello and welcome to the Mejlis Podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show focusing on Central Asia. I'm Bruce Pannier, host of the Mejlis and author of the weekly Central Asia in Focus newsletter. In May last year, it appeared Central Asia was politically moving away from Russia. Russia was a toxic partner after the Kremlin launched its full-scale war on Ukraine in late February 2022. The governments of the five Central Asian states have been working quickly since then to improve their relations with many other countries who had previously been on the fringe of Central Asian foreign policy. And yet, all five Central Asian presidents just attended the Victory Day parade in Moscow, and all five will meet on May 18th, 19th in Xi'an, China, for a summit with the Chinese president, whose country has also been exerting huge influence in Central Asia for more than two decades. What has changed and what is changing in Central Asian geopolitics? To discuss all this, I am joined by Nargiz Kaseneva, a senior fellow and director of the program on Central Asia at Harvard Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies, Paul Stronsky, a senior fellow at Carnegie Endowment's Russia and Eurasia program, where his research focuses on Russia's relationship with Central Asia and the Caucasus, and Fran Olmos, senior researcher for the Spanish-based Geopol 21 Research Center, where he specializes in Central Asian affairs and is also a research fellow at the London-based Foreign Policy Center. Thank you all for joining me. Paul, I want to start with you. It was kind of a surprise that all five of the Central Asian presidents showed up at the Victory Day parade in Moscow. I mean, you know, last week at this time, Friday, just before the Victory Day parade, only the Kyrgyz president was confirmed as going to this. And then all the presidents, all the other four Central Asian presidents, all of a sudden quickly joined in and announced that they were going to show up at this parade. What does that tell us about Central Asia's relationship with Russia right now?
Well, thanks for having me. And one of the things I think this does say, it definitely is a surprise. It didn't look like this was going to happen. And, you know, from somebody sitting in Washington right now, it's an unfortunate surprise, but not all that shocking. You know, what we see is that Moscow still has summoning power. What we see is that Moscow continues to view Central Asia as a key part of its neighborhood, and one that is essential for showing that it is not totally isolated from the rest of the world. I think what we also saw, we saw Lukashenko of Belarus there. That certainly was not pleasant company for any of them. We also saw the Armenian leader there. And if you look at Armenian relations right now, they're also very tense with Russia. So I think, you know, this is, you know, they're certainly coming. They're certainly, you know, showing some deference, willing to continue this diplomatic dance with Moscow, and, you know, realizing that Moscow can cause them a lot of harm. So when Moscow summons, they come. And I think Moscow certainly put a lot of pressure, particularly in those last few days, to make sure that they had some sort of, you know, friendly people coming to Moscow for that parade. But, you know, from a Western perspective, it doesn't look great for these countries, but I'm not totally surprised that it happened.
Great, thank you, Nargiz. You know, from the Central Asian perspective, what did it really cost them to go to something like this, right? Rather than hedging their bets, you know, why not do it? There's no harm in showing up. Understandably, Ukraine, besides Western countries, complained about it. But really, in the end, from the point of view of the Central Asian presidents, what was the harm in doing this?
Well, there was a price tag for going to the parade. That's why Central Asian leaders had been dragging their feet and basically decided to go the very last minute, except for Japarov, as you rightly pointed out, because it affects their international standing. And it's, you know, Ukrainians didn't like it, Americans didn't like it, Europeans didn't like it, and the domestic public didn't like it, particularly in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan. So it is diplomatic dance, and I would also say it's brinksmanship, because there are risks, right, that need to be taken into account and impacted the decision. They didn't want to go, so the summoning power of Moscow is weakening. The Kremlin is more desperate. I can't imagine Putin, you know, before making these calls to heads of Central Asian states, you know, kind of convincing them to come and attend the parade. Now they are desperate. They want somebody in, right? And they have more leverage in Central Asia. So there are price tags, and there is brinksmanship, and that's something basically we had to do. They had to do, not me, but the leaders, because the vulnerabilities are high, dependencies are there, and they need to be very careful in the way they manage relations with Russia. And if I can add one more thing, Bruce,
please.
If you look at Tokayev's visit, there was an attempt to kind of mitigate damage by kind of emphasizing the narrative that it's our victory as well. It's not just Russian victory. So when Tokayev went there, he paid tribute to the Kazakhs who died in the war, and so on and so forth. So that was kind of a bit of a bit of an excuse, and if I'm not sure I'm calling it right, but there was an attempt to a little bit modify the narrative.
No, that's a good point. And I believe he even visited his uncle, or his uncle was
killed.
His uncle's grave is there. So that was something. Japarov also, I believe, went to the monument that they have outside Moscow, very close to there.
So it's not just support of Putin, but it's also, it's our victory as well.
Right. Okay. No, this is a good point. I'd like to mention that the attendance at the Victory Day Parade this year stands in stark contrast to the attendance 2 years ago, when the only foreign leader was Tajikistan's president, Emomali Rahmon. So, Fran, I want to bring you in here. The Turkmen president, Turkmenistan anyway, is arguably one of the countries that has become more put more under the Russian thumb. I'll put it that way. Put more under the Russian thumb since the war started in Ukraine, and Tajikistan is another one. Certainly Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan have shown a little bit of resistance, but Turkmenistan and Tajikistan, no. If anything, they've shown that they're absolutely under the influence of Russia. Can you talk a little bit about Turkmenistan's relationship with Russia since February 2022?
Yeah, sure. What we have seen in the past year and a bit since the invasion of Ukraine, I mean, we clearly have seen a rapprochement of Russia and Turkmenistan, I think at the initiative of Moscow, to be honest. Last year, we saw a number of high-profile visits, more than we'd normally see on an average year, of ministers, speakers of Senate, of Duma, and so on and so forth. To Turkmenistan. Also, this year, in the 5 months of 2023, the trend has continued. So there's clearly an improvement in the relations between these two countries, which was not always the case under the previous regime. Let's put it like this. But the question is why this rapprochement between Moscow and Ashgabat, and we probably have to look towards north-south transit corridors that Russia now needs that will pass through Turkmenistan necessarily. Also, energy. It's clearly that Russia doesn't want Turkmenistan to export energy westwards by any way, shape, or form, and I don't think the Turkmen regime is also willing to do it at the time. But, at a time when Russia has been more isolated in the international scene, they've been looking toward, let's say, core friendships, and friendships is a big word, but countries where they have a clout, they have a potential influence. And also, let's not forget that in the last year and a half, we've seen this sort of power transition, but not really in Turkmenistan, which happened at the very same time as the war in Ukraine starting to unfold. So there's also that component, or, we don't know if Moscow sort of signed off on that, on those plans, but it's quite likely. We've clearly seen an interesting change in the dynamic of their relations. We've also seen Moscow continuing to purchase Turkmen gas, although less in 2022 than in the previous year. The war in Ukraine has had also an effect on that. But there's been clearly a new dynamic where, the so-called neutrality of Turkmenistan has probably been called into question with this new movement towards Moscow.
Mm-hmm, thanks. And, you know, Paul, Fran just brought up energy. It kind of works the other way, too. Russia might not be able to provide the security guarantees that they provided previously in Central Asia. But what are they doing with energy supplies to try to compensate for a loss, some loss of influence in the security sphere?
You know, they are certainly seeing energy as an important tool that they can try. Particularly, this is a region that has had a lot of energy shortages over the past, you know, year, and you know have perennially. Although you know some countries are very energy wealthy, they're not necessarily, those resources are not necessarily going to the populations or broadly across the populations. So we've seen that that issue, and that is something that Moscow is certainly playing on. You know, one of the things that I think is quite interesting about what we're seeing, though, is, you know, before 2022, you know, Moscow had a fair amount of soft power in the region. I think that is certainly declining. And what they have is they either have, you know, far more coercive power or coercive soft power. It's that sort of, you know, there's sort of threats. Everybody knows that Moscow can use these levers against them. You know, what we're seeing is you know, a lot of engagement, a lot of efforts to placate Moscow and to sort of minimize some of those risks as these countries kind of diversify a little bit, seek ways to diversify against Moscow. But the sheer reality is this is an isolated part of the world. It's hard to reach every other, you know, global market. And that also provides Moscow with a lot of leverage moving forward.
Okay, thank you. Okay, let's move the Central Asian leaders along, because next week they're all going to be together once again in China for a summit with the Chinese president. Nargis, how do you read this move? Part of continued policy with China, or is there a new relationship, a new emphasis on relations with China?
I think it's, to a large extent, it is a continuation, right? China-Central Asia relations have been, you know, growing better and bigger and, you know, over the past three decades. But the war in Ukraine definitely gave it another boost. And the kind of the balance has shifted. The role of Russia as the regional leader has been negatively affected by what Russia has been doing. And it's sort of, you mentioned the coercive power. The coercive power is definitely there. And there is, you know, there is fear of Russia using this coercive power. And clearly Russia feels less constraints to do that. But the legitimacy of Russia as the regional leader is down, and against that, China looks better. China kind of gains in legitimacy where Russia is losing it. So we see Central Asian states leaning more onto China now, as a partner, as a provider, to some extent, provider of security, an economic power that can invest, they can do trade, that can help them to diversify. So all these things that China already had been providing, now kind of there is more need for that. And it seems China is ready to oblige, and the upcoming summit is one example of that.
Thank you. You know, Fran, what about the debt trap, the Chinese debt trap? How worried should the Central Asians be about, you know, clearly they're losing Russia as a partner, including as an economic and trade partner. Last year was a good year, but you can't expect that to last over the near-term future. I think every year probably be a little bit less. How reliable is China, considering how deeply in debt some of these Central Asian countries are?
Well, this is a factor that plagues or affects the relationship, especially with Tajikistan and Kyrgyzstan. So I mean, it's a double on the investments and funds lended by mostly the Exim Bank from China. It's a bit of a double-edged sword. On the one hand, it's helping these countries to build infrastructure. On the other hand, it's tying them closer, whether they like it or not, to Beijing in the future. Now the question is probably not at this moment in time, but it's more over the, you know, throughout the next years, when as long as they, how they're going to be able to repay these debts. So, and especially in the case of Tajikistan, where the regime is more, less transparent, let's put it like this, and there's more, much more corruption, we will see if, you know, this translates into mining concessions, translates into, who knows, exchanging territory. I mean, 10, over a decade ago, Tajikistan ceded territory to China, nothing to do with debt or repaying debt, but it does have a quite of a worrying precedent for these two countries. So, I mean, they cannot do much about it at the time being. I mean, they need those funds. We had, apart from their economy is probably not the most brilliant. Plus, on top of that, we had the pandemic, we had the war in Ukraine. So things are not looking good from an economic perspective. And, you know, there's not much that can be done in that aspect. But of course, I mean, that doesn't mean that they cannot leverage other items, especially Tajikistan when it comes to security, as we have seen China being worried or concerned of any danger that could spill from Afghanistan via Tajikistan into its own territory, hence the base that opened a few years ago and the investments done in Chinese security and facilities along the Afghan-Tajik border. So there's not much that they could do, these two countries. They have to keep an eye on it. So I wouldn't be that too optimistic in that regard. But it's the future when it comes to repaying those debts that will tell us what the story will look like.
Okay, thanks. And you know, Paul, I got to give you a chance to talk about this too. But as much as you could from the Chinese perspective, I mean, there's a symbolism even about next week's meeting, right? That it's being held in Xi'an. It could have been held in Shanghai because four of the five Central Asian countries are in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. It could have been held in Beijing, the capital of China. But this one's in Xi'an, and you get the feeling that this is almost a special pick for a venue because, of course, the Chinese emperor from a couple of millennia ago was living in Xi'an when it was then called Chang'an, when they first established contacts with the Central Asians. So there seems to be something of a Silk Route connection that they're trying to imply with this whole meeting. But how does China look at their relations with Central Asia? They haven't really pressed Russia's weakness, but how are they looking at Central Asia now, no, understanding that Russia has got one hand tied behind its back, so to speak?
Yeah, well, I think you nailed it right there with the symbolism of Xi'an. I mean, I think it's definitely highlighting that China today sees Central Asia as part of its backyard as well. And I think China has always seen that. It hasn't really had to worry about it that much because, you know, Russia was there, the United States were there. It might not have liked all of that, but at least they were playing stabilizing roles at various times. Neither of them are there anymore. So I think, you know, this is, you know, we generally see China as a sort of an East Asian, Asian Pacific type of, in geopolitical terms. But for China, I mean, Central Asia is just as important as Southeast Asia, the South China Sea, and all those other areas for its own stability. And so I think that is, certainly a driver in what we see. And so, you know, it'll be quite interesting to sort of see how this all plays out over the next year or so, because, you know, China is, it has talked a great talk, but it's still, it has its own economic challenges. I think, you know, many of the Central Asian states, they might not like, you know, the tremendous economic clout, but there's not, you know, China's coming with money. The West is coming with sanctions, and you know other people who are other powers are entering. You know, looking at the region, but China's the one that traditionally has brought some money. Whether or not China will be able to live up to some of those expectations moving forward isn't quite clear. But I think this certainly says China is in the region. China is connected to the region, and these countries are now connected much more closely to China. And I think you just can kind of see some of, the visa agreements, some of the increase in trade. It also highlights, the pandemic is over and the pandemic was kind of a blip where, we saw a disruption in some of these relationships. But now, China is back in Central Asia. And I think that the summit in Xi'an certainly indicates, at least from the Chinese perspective, that they see themselves as a key part of Central Asia.
Great, thank you. Okay, let's move on to some of these other players here too, because there's been...
Bruce, can I jump in?
Yeah, sure. Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Very briefly. I think I somewhat disagree with what Fran said. I think China has been investing in good neighborly relations with Central Asia for 30 years. And it's important for China to have a very kind of friendly, secure neighborhood. So, and that was important for security purposes, also for the development purposes, because, you know, Xinjiang, Western China is embedded in these kind of surrounding regions, but also it's important for China's standing as a, you know, aspiring global power, or maybe without aspiring, we should strike that. It wants these good working functional relations with different regions of the world, and Central Asia is even a neighborhood, so it's even more important. And that's why the question of debt, of course, is there, but I don't think it will do anything that would create animosity in Central Asian countries. So it would be easier for China to be benevolent, to forgive some debt, to restructure it, than, you know, to actually, you know, push the countries to the wall and kind of demand the payment or big concessions. That would be my reading of the situation.
Bill, I could just throw in a comment in there too. You know, Paul had mentioned that China has its own economic problems at the moment. There's not likely to be much more big Chinese money coming into Central Asia for a while. Shouldn't that worry the Central Asians? I mean, there's two unfinished projects of the big projects from years ago that they put on the table, the railway, China, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan, and Line D of the gas pipeline from Turkmenistan. But other than that, there are no multi-billion dollar projects coming from China. So that,
which is good. But there is a bigger diversity of these projects, and we see investments in agribusiness. We see investments in renewable energy sector. So let's see what's going to happen with the ICT, and you know, so there is a variety, and definitely the connections are growing, and Central Asian, you know, governments are so interested in deepening these relations and having access to Chinese markets, to having Chinese investments. They are working hard on, you know, making sure there is certification of their products, and so on and so forth. So I wouldn't worry about that. I think the era of big you know, loans is probably over, but it's not the end of the story. I think we are in stage two now.
Okay, thanks. You know, Fran, I want to get to you because I want to talk about some of these other countries. I'd call them fringe countries, but of course, a lot of them have actually had some influence in Central Asia for a while. You know, we were talking about loans and money. The Central Asians have been turning to the Arab states to see if they could get money now, and it's probably sensing that they already are too much in debt to China. They've been looking to other countries for security. So can you talk a little bit about some of the, you know, Turkey and Iran for a start, and how relations with the Central Asian states have changed with Turkey and Iran since Russia started its war in Ukraine last year?
Yeah, so I think the most telling case here is that of Turkey and the Central Asian states, mostly the fourth Turkic one, so not Tajikistan, although there's also important links there. I mean, at the end of the day, what many of these countries look towards Turkey as a, just another alternative to diversify their foreign policy besides Russia, China, and the West. So it's just another useful alternative. On the other hand, we see Ankara push quite hard. It's very encouraged, pushing its own agenda, namely the organization of Turkic states from a political point of view. Here we see President Erdogan pushing very hard for term membership, which he still hasn't got, despite trying for quite a while. There's indications that, you know, that might happen in the near future, but that was also the case last year, and it never happened. So in this case, they're looking more, and it's not just the soft power that traditionally comes with Turkey in Central Asia in terms of cultural and, you know, heritage, history, and so on. But we're looking also more hard power in terms of military agreements, cooperation, military hardware, not only, but probably the most striking thing, the drones. But it's not just limited to drones. There's also drills, military exercises. The Turkish Navy pretty much is all armed with the Turkish vessels and so on and so forth. So the war in Ukraine has also meant, in my opinion, that these countries, which they're always, you know, in good terms with Turkey, and, you know, there's been better commercial links also, but probably it's encouraged them even more to open themselves and to collaborate more with Ankara, while this plays into what I think Erdogan is looking. And there's also the energy component in that regard, on the aspiration of Turkey becoming a hub for gas for the West. And here we see, again, Erdogan pushing the Turkmen regime to bring gas westwards. And so far, he has not been successful. So, I mean, probably that's not going to happen anytime soon. But it's a clear alternative. And when it comes to Iran, there was a bit of a frenzy last year in terms of Tokayev went to Tehran, Rahmon went to Tehran, Berdimuhamedov, the son, went to Tehran. So we've seen a number of agreements being signed. The numbers in terms of trade have improved, and that in that area the main topic remains transit. I mean, both from an east-west perspective and also north-south corridor, Iran is key, and also its ports in the Persian Gulf, Chabahar, it remains key for the country. So again, it's another way to diversify foreign policy, but for Iran, is mostly related to its geographical location and the potential of transit for commercial routes.
Okay, great. Thank you. And we have reached the halfway point in our discussion, so it's time for me to remind that this is the Mejlis podcast, Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty's current affairs talk show, focusing on Central Asia. And I'm Bruce Pannier, host of the Mejlis and author of the weekly Central Asia in Focus newsletter. And today we're talking about the shifting foreign policy landscape in Central Asia. And joining me for this discussion are Paul Stronsky, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment's Russia and Eurasia program, where his research focuses on Russia's relationship with Central Asia and the Caucasus. Francis Olmos, senior researcher for the Spanish-based Geopol 21 Research Center, where he specializes in Central Asian affairs, and also is a research fellow at the London-based Foreign Policy Center, and Nargiz Khasanova, a senior fellow and director of the program on Central Asia at Harvard Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies. Thanks again for being on the program. Fran, I'm going to pick it right back up with you because I want to give you a chance to talk just briefly about the relationship between Central Asia and some of the Arab states since last February.
Yes. So, I mean, when we talk about Central Asian states, the Arab states, we normally think about oil and fossil fuels. Now, there's a very interesting trend being developed for the last couple of years, but especially this year in 2022, which is the role played by Saudi Arabia and the UAE in the renewable energy space, mostly for Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan. We've seen multi-billion dollar investments that have been signed or earmarked for solar and wind power in both countries, also to a lesser extent for Kyrgyzstan. So there's an interesting trend being developed there beyond the traditional financing, other projects that we might be more familiar with, like the UAE saying they will help Turkmenistan develop its Kalkinish gas field, and the more, traditional projects that we come to expect. But that's an interesting trend. Also, we'll see the Emir of Qatar. He met Tokayev last year. The Emir of Qatar will visit Uzbekistan this year. We've also seen lots of visits back and forth between the Gulf and Turkmenistan. So they're clearly also looking at the Persian Gulf as another way to diversify, to look for investment. And like I mentioned, that interesting trend in when it comes to renewable energies, it looks like they're miles ahead of other countries in Central Asia in that regard.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Nargiz, you know, same. And Paul, I'm going to you have a chance in this right after Nargiz too, but the same countries. You know, they're all, do they have some kind of advantage, or do you see that there's some kind of advantage in the fact that these are all Islamic countries? You know, we know that Iran is Shiite government, but still, it's not just a shift in trade in some ways, but it's also a shift to a culture that Central Asia had a connection with for 1,000 years until it was interrupted by the Soviet Union.
Well, affinities are important, but these are such different countries, regions, and each has its own strengths and weaknesses with regard to relations. Turkey, of course, is the closest and the most trusted among external actors, players, but it's remote, and the economic situation is there is difficult, so we don't know how much Turkey can do, what type of investments and so on and so forth. But the ambitions are definitely there. Let's also see what the elections will bring us, whether there will be a modification of Turkey's foreign policy course. If the opposition comes, it seems that there will be, we can expect some improvement of relations with the West, and that might be good also for us, because Turkey is the bridge that connects our regions via, of course, the South Caucasus with Europe. The Gulf has plenty of money. Culturally, I wouldn't say there is much affinity, but you know, of course, the Mecca and Medina there, you know, people go for Hajj and people go for tourism there, and they buy property and so on and so forth. So that's the big advantage, right, of the Gulf. Iran is the kind of has the weakest cards, but its strongest card is the geographical situation, and that would be the shortest way to get to the oceans. So we are waiting what's going to happen with the sanctions, and if the sanctions are lifted, I would expect a big upsurge in connections.
Okay, thanks, Paul.
Yeah, so I mean, I first of all, I fully agree with Nargis on Iran, and I also, unless those sanctions are lifted, it's always going to be a very careful dance because of pushback, particularly from the United States, and we'll see what kind of government the United States has in 2 years, which could also impact any of that on sort of the connections between the Gulf, Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar, and Central Asia. I would differ a little bit from Nargis, not so much on the sort of, common Muslim, common Islamic heritage, but, they do see the world differently and do have very different traditions. But what I think does bring these countries together is they are very similar in their political models. And UAE, Qatar, Saudi Arabia are all, autocracies. They are not free democratic societies. So unlike the West, they are coming in and not asking, those pesky questions that nobody wants to hear. They do not have that sort of same power as, the financial power and sort of that clout that China has. And they're not Russia. So they are and when you look at UAE, if you've been there, you see, high standards of living, you see social safety nets that actually are working much better than what's working in Central Asia. You see Dubai and Abu Dhabi, were sort of the models for Astana in many ways. So you sort of see some of these sort of particularly among elite levels, some of those connections. And the other thing that I would also argue is, UAE, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, they have their ups and downs with the United States, but and with Europe, but generally, the relations are positive. But they also have decent relations with these countries. Also have decent relations with Russia and China at the same time. So these are relatively safe ways to sort of diversify. You don't have the sort of the democracy, human rights issues. They, have pretty good relations with everybody around, and so I think this is an important driver. And I would definitely think things such as investment in the tourism. I think we're going to probably see a little bit more in logistics, air, but also agribusiness, IT, all those things. I think that is good because unlike everything that China has done, And I think this next stage of Chinese engagement, economic engagement, might also be a little bit positive because it's not just building infrastructure and throughput. You know, some of this could actually build greater opportunities in Central Asia. I'd also like to bring up one other country, which is India, because I think India is a country to watch, both because of this budding IT sector in Central Asia. Well, India is that's one of its premier. It's a premier global country for IT, but also I think just like Turkey is an alternative in sort of security, particularly defense purchases. India can be as well, and I think we're probably going to see a lot more discussions on that front coming up. Particularly as Russia is struggling to refill and create its own components to keep its own military alive, and sanctions are just going to make that worse. Well, this is India is a place that they certainly could look to as well as an alternative, and so I think that's something we should probably be watching as well.
Okay, great, thanks. And I want to turn to the Central Asian governments themselves. Certainly this situation is presenting some opportunities for them also, because we do have all these other countries which were kind of at arm's distance for a while, but now are showing much greater interest in Central Asia. And I would even include the European Union in this. So my question is, what have the Central Asians been able to, that you see that they've been able to gain for this? And if I could just start the ball rolling by mentioning the fact that, we have seen a presidential election and change of constitution in Kazakhstan. We've seen a change of constitution. We're about to see another presidential election in Uzbekistan. You get the impression that the Western governments are leaning off these countries over incidents like Karakal, Pakistan, the violence there last year, or Gorno-Badakhshan in Tajikistan, because they don't want to push these countries back into the Russian camp or do anything that would push them back. But the Central Asians seem to be taking advantage of that because this muted criticism allows them to consolidate their own regimes, for one thing. But do you see that happening? And do you see any other ways in which the Central Asians are actually using Russia's war to their own advantage domestically? And Paul, I'll start with you.
Yes. I mean, certainly, we saw some of those financial flows that came in. I think a lot of that was capital flight over the last year. So it's probably not going to repeat itself, but that certainly helped, shore up economies over the past year. So they've been able to take advantage of that in some ways. I do think we are seeing less of a criticism, particularly of Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. I think the West sees those as the most important interlocutors for the entire region. Honestly, sitting here in Washington, there's not much hope for Turkmenistan, not much hope for Tajikistan. All the indicators are going backward. But, although we've seen, slowing on the reform front all around, I think the West is still betting on Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. And they also see both of these countries as important for promoting regional cooperation. And I think, if you hear here in Washington, regional cooperation also helps build the region's resilience. It's not just one country vis-a-vis Russia or one country vis-a-vis China. If they're working together, it's a bigger market. They can attract more investors, a bigger market, for people to sell to, but also, bigger clout. Globally, if they're working together, so I definitely see a little bit of back off on, particularly in criticizing Uzbekistan and Kazakhstan. There's still silent and quiet criticism going on, and lots of conversations. But I think some of the vocal things that we've heard in the past few years are there, and I think we're also seeing more interest. The IT sector. I've had a lot of Japanese and Korean people come and talk to me about opportunities there, because they also recognize, maybe the Chinese will go in there. So I think, we're seeing, it's not just, the Europeans. We're seeing, other Asians who've traditionally been there, but marginal players are also suddenly looking back again. And they also, they're not going to talk about human rights either.
Okay, thank you. Fran. To you, do you see any of the Central Asian countries or Central Asia as a region actually profiting recently from the changes since the Russia launched its war in Ukraine?
Yes, I mean, I agree with both you and Paul and what you were saying. And I would add, to some extent, when it comes to the EU and Uzbekistan, of course, I think part of it is, trying to they realized in terms of foreign policy that it's more of a reliable partner, them and Kazakhstan, in the last years, and not wanting to push them too hard. But also, I think to some circles in Brussels, there's probably a bit of a naivete towards Uzbekistan. I mean, the Uzbek regime has done great PR, public relations, efforts in the last 5 years or so. So I think there's also some people in Brussels have actually bought into the narrative of reforms and so on. So I think it's, on the one hand, is what you and Paul mentioned. And also on the other hand, I think there's a bit of a, they've actually believed or they've bought into some of those PR campaigns, which reminds one also of what Kazakhstan did in the past. So there's a clear benefit there. Then from an economical point of view, we could also look into the secondary re-exportation of goods through mostly Kazakhstan, the goods, consumer goods. So it's in a small scale, but that's probably also had an impact. And then we also see the EU starting to court, or, you know, again, there's the talks of bringing gas from Turkmenistan, or, you know, the topic was dead for a few years. So it's reignited that interest. Of course, the difficulties are tremendous, and, you know, it's very unlikely that's ever going to happen. But it's brought back to the conversation topics that were probably long gone, or, you know, they were in a drawer somewhere full of dust in Brussels, and they're starting to bring those back out. So, you know, potentially there's ways that Turkmenistan in this case could benefit, even though in the end they might not actually do anything, any actions, but they could become more, even more lenient with that regime in particular.
Okay, thank you. And Nargiz, give you the last word on this. Central Asians, is it, they finding some advantage in this situation for themselves?
Well, what you started with the political elites, I think it's complicated. The political elites and human rights, good governance agenda. I think it's complicated because on the one hand, indeed, the war in Ukraine overtook all the other agendas, and the priority is to make sure the countries are not aligning too much with Russia, are not helping Russia. So in this sense, yes, they can, you know, the governments can get away with it. But on the other hand, we do need the West more than ever. So it is of existential nature now, which creates some leverage for the West actually to push. So, but of course, it needs to be calibrated, and it is not easy. It will not be easy in terms of opportunities. Yes, some opportunities did arise, and there are hopes to become this economic bridge, and the as Tokayev said it, we want to become the economic buffer zone between North and South, East and West. So that's the goal of the efforts, and there are companies relocating and so on and so forth. But there is also some skepticism. What can work out? We definitely need a corridor, and Kazakhstan and Uzbekistan to some extent are pushing for this middle corridor. The EU is ready to support the middle corridor. Turkey is that's Turkey's project, but it's not sure yet whether it would work out or not. The obstacles are considerable. I think what Central Asians can do and should do is to develop regional cooperation. And we see some signs of that now, and, you know, kind of we can be cautiously optimistic. I would think if we can cooperate, coordinate, then the region can be of more interest to to other players, to the European Union and to US and to the others. So let's see how it goes. I think we have a lot on our plate, and the challenge is high. But I hope that the sense of crisis will help.
Okay, thank you. Obviously, we could devote a 3 or 4 day seminar to these topics that we've been covering today, but I do thank you all for helping me and our audience to understand what's been changing in Central Asia. So thank you, Fran and Nargiz and Paul. And a big thank you, as always, to Nathan Shoemaker, our Mejlis podcast producer in Washington, D.C. And a reminder, you can subscribe to the Mejlis podcast or the Central Asia in Focus newsletter by visiting Radio for Europe, Radio Liberty's website at rfarl.org. Thanks, and we'll be back next week. Bye-bye.